Well, I don't know if I would have written Rubik without writing the PhD, because, like, it just... it was just such a luxury, like, just being able to read lots of, you know, critical theories and read other books and, like, think about them critically. And, like, it gave Rubik a richness that it wouldn't have had if it was just me, you know, in my bedroom, you know, just writing in bed kind of thing. So, I mean, I have gratitude to that and to the research process. But I think in terms of, like, just like, day-to-day life, because I teach a lot at Curtin, and not even like a lot, like I have one class, but it just takes up so much of my headspace, and I end up reading I guess not as much for pleasure, but I'm like, I'm reading something, I'm like, oh, can I repurpose this for class, or can I, or we're studying personal essays, so I'm reading lots of personal essays, and so a lot of it's hard to find, I guess, food to feed my writing instead of, finding things that can be used for teaching purposes. Mm-hmm. So it's a balance that I'm still trying to figure out. But there's sometimes, like, because I normally start off the year with doing a class called Writing Short Fiction, and I think that's actually when I tend to write the most, like, because I'm thinking about these concepts and, like, I'm giving the students these writing exercises and I'm like, oh, maybe I should try that out myself. And so I tend to, to be more productive in that first semester, even though it's, like, crazy busy. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Rowena, yours, am I right in thinking your PhD was not a creative writing PhD?
I wrote some of the stories as part of the PhD, and I also did a sociological study of Indian writers in India, emerging writers, and because of which I had the privilege of interviewing writers who had not yet been published, some who had already been published, but I got a sense of the commonalities of the struggle of writers across the world. I just want to say one thing about the Writers Festivals question and then come back to the PhD question. A writer in India while I was doing my PhD, and someone I interviewed, said Writers Festivals are the new literary pages of journals and newspapers, because literary pages are shrinking. Reviewing spaces are shrinking today. They're almost non-existent in Australian publications, mainstream publications. So writers' festivals are where readers get to hear about writers and what writers think, and, you know, the word of mouth that gets spread about certain writers. I think that's one of the roles of a writers' festival is to kind of add value in some ways to do the work that critics used to do, sadly. I mean, we can have both, you know. We want to have more literary pages in newspapers and in mainstream newspapers, but writers' festivals, that's one of the roles that they play these days, I feel, and that's a really good thing. In terms of the PhD, I found that it was a very... it was a liberating experience for me. There's the perception that doing a creative writing PhD is kind of like, you know, you get told how to write and you have to write in a particular way. Maybe that's the experience for some people. It wasn't for me. There wasn't anyone telling me that this is wrong and that is right. There was a lot of freedom that I had. Maybe it was my particular institution and my supervisors, I'm not sure. But I think what a PhD does, it gives you the time and the space to write, to create a work, a long work or a body of work. And it gives you that institutional backing, institutional support. Of course, there are lots of problems with institutions and neoliberal education, that system that we have these days in most countries. But I'm all for people doing creative writing PhDs, as long as you can find the right supervisor, a nurturing supervisor, and a supportive institution. But good luck with that. Having said all of that,
in terms of having a diverse range of voices in book publishing, it's been significantly better over the past few years, I think. But in terms of criticism and major critics writing for newspapers and those ever-shrinking literary pages, it's still limited. Do you feel as though this has an influence on the reception of work?
The reviews that I've had have been quite positive, but that's a huge exception. I know a lot of writers of colour who get reviewed by writers who have no clue about the literary world they're engaging with. And so the best parts of the work are completely missed out. So it's, I think it's really important, and there are initiatives now being developed by different organizations for nurturing critics of color, you know, critics who can understand, reviewers who can understand the work that and the literary world that is being created in that text. So I think it's really important to have a diversity of cultural diversity of writers, but also of reviewers and critics. I think that's extremely crucial. In terms of like the critic not getting it, the positions of power that critics have, and their the kind of warped worldview that they bring. My book was reviewed positively by two people, but one of the criticisms they had was, where are all the Hindus in the book? This is not about the Indian Catholics. Where are the Hindus? Of course, I understand the issues with Catholicism and conversion and all of that, but the whole of Indian literature for centuries has been about Hindus and the romantic patriarchal society. So when the ants are writing the story of the jungle, don't ask where the lions are. So that's, I'm just trivializing it, of course, but you know, the similar things happen with indigenous writers here, with other writers from minority communities, whether they be ethnic or religious minorities or, you know, sexual minorities. It's when someone from the mainstream, someone with power who cannot even see their own privilege, you know, in terms of ability as well, when those kinds of people review the work of writers from minority communities, it can be quite actually racist, insensitive, and rubbish, really, the reviews and the interpretation, because a lot of readers rely on that interpretation, and they take as truth what the reviewer writes about that book. So it can really make or break a writer's reception. It's extremely crucial. It's extremely crucial to have interviewers who are sensitive, not sympathetic, but sensitive, who understand the world and critique your work on the basis of the work, not whether you're an exotic creature or not an exotic creature. So I think it's extremely important to have that sensitivity with people who are the gatekeepers, who let you in, who don't let you in through their questions, their reviews, their interpretation of your work, because the general public is relying on them to tell the general public what to make of this thing, this new thing. Yeah.
Elizabeth, are you ever tempted to write criticism yourself? Are you...
No. I'm so apologetic about my opinion about anything. I'm just like, no. But, I mean, I will say that, like, I think the reviews that I cherished the most for Rubik were from other critics of... from people of colour, and they recognised, like, what I was trying to do with Rubik in, like, naming my characters... giving my characters names that suggest their racial background, and just noticing that, but also that they're permitted to just exist in the world, and it's not it's essential and also not essential to their identity, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess in the same way that I experience my own ethnicity, it's it is and isn't essential, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And we do still have a long way to go with book publishing, because it's dominated by white middle-class women like me. Except for the bosses, who are white middle-class men.
Yeah.
But, you know, one step at a time.
Yeah.
So now we have some time for audience questions, if any of you would like to ask something. Otherwise, I will carry on. I would like... Oh, there's one in the front. Yeah.
I've got a question about language. You know, you write about characters. I haven't read your book yet, but I understand you, and I heard you interviewed on the radio. You write about characters that come from another culture who presumably have another language. When I was reading Elena Ferrante, I noticed that she writes in Italian, but at crucial, and she uses a small amount of Neapolitan dialect because it's said in that book. But at certain points, her characters speak in Neapolitan dialect, and she always signals that in dialect I said, that she didn't necessarily use it. And it started me thinking about, you know, I also write about characters who speak another language. What do my characters think in their own dreams, if you know what I mean, yes. that I'm depicting them in English, but they're actually, sometimes they don't even speak English, and sometimes they speak English in other language. This is a bit of a stupid question, but I've started thinking, you know, there is potentially another dimension to my characters that I'm representing. Do you have any views about that? I mean, do you have any feeling about that in terms of your own characters?
Yeah, there's always a sense of loss, isn't there, when you are representing someone's experience in a language that's not the language of those characters. Always that sense of loss. With my characters, they're all English-speaking. Yeah. Again, that is because of a process of colonization. English is my first language, and I love it. But I also know that it comes because I have lost the other languages. I mean, of course, I was forced to study Hindi and Marathi and French in school and hated it, all three languages. Now I love them. I can't speak them very well. But English is my language. It is my language. I claim it. And... So the characters in my book are kind of in English-speaking, urban, middle-class women in Sydney, and privileged in many ways. But yes, there is definitely, I completely agree, there's a sense of loss of language when you are representing characters whose first language may not be the language that you're writing in. Yeah, I completely understand that.
Elizabeth, in your Lenny Letter essay, you were talking a bit about, or should I say, Westerly essay. I should give
it. It's worth.
You were talking about languages and your experience of them. Can you talk a bit about access to and memory of different languages and
I only speak English. I was kind of briefly forced to go to Chinese school on a Saturday morning when I was in my childhood, and it just never really took. And I guess my essay on Lenny Letter was just kind of about that loss of, and just being so conscious of, I guess, the sacrifices that my parents made and the sacrifices that you have to make in order to pass as an Australian and to be accepted as an Australian. So I guess... Especially since, you know, my dad passed away, 2.5 years ago, I've just become so conscious of, even though, I have a kind of degree of privilege of being able to, I have the accent and I can make my way in Australia as an Australian, I'm a beneficiary that way, but there's still, there's a kind of grief at the back of my mind or at the back of my heart all the time, just sort of, there's another self that I could have had, maybe.
This is a very different kind of question, and thank you both for your wonderful books. They're such a pleasure to read, both of them. So you mentioned satire and humour, and because we typically think of the little satire in particular as having a negative impulse, but they always imply a set of ideals. So can I ask you about that old-fashioned question, what are the values that underpin your books? What is it that you want readers to cherish?
I would like my readers to to feel okay with their confusion and feel okay with their loneliness. Because a lot of my characters are I think of them as behind the curve kind of characters. They don't know what's going on and they don't know what questions to ask. That's kind of what I would like my readers to feel like. You know, a lot of people don't know how to interact with other people, how to be on a panel, or how to apply for your own Medicare card, or put all your super in one account. And a lot of everyone's struggling with that. Yeah.
And then the guilt when you have to.
Yes.
Thanks for that great question. I think for me, what I would like readers to cherish would be that, this is another way to think about being Australian. Or this is another way of being Indian. This is another perspective on Australianness or Indianness, or, you know, being an outsider, being in two places, being from two places. So for someone like you, Elizabeth, you were born here,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to ask you, where are you from? That's kind of slightly an offensive question. But to someone like me who came here as an adult, I want to give you my whole backstory when you ask me. Because I want to say, I'm from Bombay and do you know about this and have you been there? But I guess it depends on, you know, your position in Australian society. So what's... And it depends on who's asking the question as well.
Yeah, it can be a solidarity kind of thing.
It's a
I don't mind it.
Yes.
It's from someone who looks... yeah, yeah,
but
it's different.
Yeah. Oh, but when it's the tone, right? When they're
yes.
asking you to actually put those bars, like you're not one of us. Where are you from?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. yeah.
But it's a condition of Australia today. Huge millions of Australians are from other places and now live here, first generation immigrants. So that condition of being from more than one place is actually quite a common thing. And I would love, that's what I want readers to take away from my book, if anything, that, you know, oh, this is a different way of looking at the world. That's all. And hopefully enjoy the book.